Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Prisons and jails are built on or near landfills, toxic waste dumps, Superfund cleanup sites, and coal mining sites. These prisons are vulnerable to natural disasters such as flooding, environmental hazards like contaminated water. Prison populations are overwhelmingly composed of low-income people of color, Black, Hispanic, Latino, and Native Americans. Prisons and jails in the United States are consistently overpopulated and overrepresented. The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world, with more than 2.3 million people behind bars. Why is that? Joining me, I'd like to say thank you to my guest today. I have a special group of folks who are just really dynamic and know exactly what's happening. So joining me here in the studio, I welcome Brian Damage. Brian is the director of The Place Collective.
Thanks for having me.
And I have Shelby Shoup. And Shelby is an organizer of the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Hi, glad to be here.
And on the phone, I welcome Panyoti Chokas. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that was good.
All right. He's based in Alachua County. He is the co-founder of the Fight Toxic Prisons, a national collective of organizers focused on the intersection of environmental justice and prison abolition. And I also welcome from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Chandre Delaney. Chandre is the mother of a formerly incarcerated son and an advocate for prisoners in Pennsylvania. Chandre, welcome to 411 Team.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Okay. My opening question to you all is to educate us. Tell us about it. I mean, when I mentioned I was having a program on toxic prisons, folks were like, what? What is that? Where'd that come from? So, you know, this is about teaching, and it's your turn to teach. So tell us, what are toxic prisons? Where are they? And I guess I'm looking at you, Brian, so you're in the hot seat, but if you don't want to and you want to defer, whatever you want to do.
So the prison industry in this country is very, in the state particularly, is very toxic and harmful to communities across Florida. And it's not just a local thing.
You know, DOCs all over the state, basically, the logic of toxic prisons is the people that we find disposable, we're going to put those with the things that we find disposable. We're going to put incarcerated people next to these toxic landfills and dumps. And you have these people and these things that are basically discarded and then becoming sick and getting cancer and drinking undrinkable water. And we don't hear about this very often because, you know, so many of these people who could be telling these stories are locked up most of the times, like hundreds of miles from their family or people who could be amplifying their stories.
Okay. Panayoti, comments?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, echoing what was just said by Shelby and Brian, but giving some specific examples, you know, here in Florida, there are multiple prisons that are, you know, directly adjacent to landfill sites. There's proposals on top of that to then, you know, conduct additional heavy industrial activity. For example, the county north of Alachua, we've been looking at a proposal to mine 10,000 acres for phosphate, huge phosphate mine, notorious for contamination and pollution. We saw in 2016 with this massive, chemical spill that opened up, basically went into the aquifer from a sinkhole underneath the waste, you know, pile of waste from the phosphate mine. So we know this industry has a record of contaminating the environment and in Union and Bradford counties, which are both very, you know, they're both basically prison towns. They have multiple prisons. One facility would be, you know, between the landfill and the proposed phosphate mine, not just you know, any prison, but specifically this is the Lake Butler Medical and Reception Center. So people that have already have illnesses and are, you know, being poorly treated for their medical conditions, then would be stuck, you know, in this increasingly toxic environment. You know, the Coleman Federal Prison, which is one of the largest prisons in the country, and federal prison that houses inmates from all over the country. They're surrounded by rock mine operations, which have a history of, you know, contaminating water and causing other sorts of pollution. So these are a couple examples, you know, along with what you mentioned about prisons near the coast experiencing mm-hmm. floods and damage related to, you know, natural disasters, as we saw in the Panhandle. The prisons up there are still dealing with the damage that a lot of people, you know, thought that they were being evacuated, and they weren't. You know, it had mm-hmm. we were taking in rain from the roof. Right. People were standing in water for days. And in some instances, this is still occurring. And so those are the sort of things that we're talking about. And then even beyond that, looking at some of the connections between, you know, prison labor. For example, in Hamilton, the Hamilton Correctional Institution, you know, the prisoners actually run the landfill across the street for no pay. They're used as essentially slaves, mm-hmm. you know, prison slave labor, and doing this work in the landfill. We saw prisoners from county jails this year out cleaning up dead fish from the red tide that hit both coasts. You know, so this mm-hmm. kind of work without proper safety equipment, picking up these contaminated fish that just line the beach. So those are the sort of things that we talk about, you know, toxic prisons and environmental justice for prisoners, but also looking at the bigger picture, prison labor and prison health, conditions okay. of confinement, and really exploring all those things.
And Chandra, you're in Pennsylvania.
Yes. Basically, the same issues that they're having all around the country, Pennsylvania is not excluded from that. We have some of the oldest prisons in the country, and a lot of these prisons have plumbing that has not been updated. So we have prisoners essentially drinking the same water that people are drinking in Flint, Michigan, and it's not being talked about or nothing's being done about it because they're prisoners. Just to add a little bit more to it, I would say the physical environment itself inside of the prison is toxic. The things that the prisoners have to deal with, the toxic foods that they're giving them, you know, they're basically feeding them slop. So it's not healthy and it's not good for them. They're placing people in solitary confinement for long periods of time, which is, you know, making people who were not mentally ill, mm-hmm. mentally ill in a matter of weeks, it can happen. And while they're in there, they're being physically abused. So it's the earth and the environment, but it's also the environment within the prisons and what the prisoners are experiencing within the prisons.
Now, you all are all grassroots organizations, okay? And I guess it's just a coalition amongst all of the different grassroots that are fighting this toxic prison. I'm saying this because I want to make sure I've got the right idea. What kind of reception do you get? I mean, how are people in the community receiving you? I would think that they would be, you know, glad to see you, because usually the prison communities are just as vulnerable as the prisoners themselves.
So, you know, talking from the experience of someone who organizes with the party, we got plugged in with Fight Toxic Prisons and the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee last year when we were working around the prison strike together. Mm-hmm. I think that something that we saw, you know, sometimes when we're doing these more like I don't even want to say they're radical actions because they're not. You know, protesting outside the DOC with signs and megaphones is not inherently radical. Something that Fight Toxic Prisons and Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee does that I think is just wonderful is they'll have movie nights where they like blow up a big projector and face it towards the prisons. So prisoners and, you know, their comrades on the outside can be watching a movie together. These things might be perceived, you know, as radical by the people whose voices are loudest in the media. But I think that our community is more receptive to the idea of prisoners' rights than people might assume. And I think that's really evidenced by, you know, the passage of Amendment 4, which just went into effect on, you know, yesterday on Inauguration Day, which restores voting rights to returning citizens or formerly incarcerated persons. I think the support is out there. You know, one in three Americans know someone who's been incarcerated. This issue affects so many families, so many communities. It's just a matter of reaching out to these families and communities, so many of whom have been disempowered by these structures. And by the sort of generational impact that incarceration can have, and empowering them and making these connections with them and making connections with people on the inside. And I think that, you know, as we continue to do that, we realize that we have a lot more people power than people might assume.
Okay.
Great.
Yes. Pada? Yeah, feel free.
Well, I guess I'm thinking of another example. You know, while I think all of us on this call here have a concern for the health and conditions of people who are in prisons in all of our areas, you know, and around the country. But it's a, to me, it's pretty clear it's a human rights issue, and really it's like incarceration has become like an epidemic in this country. As you noted earlier, you know, we're the largest prison population in the world. But it's also something that I think people who haven't quite seen or haven't found the concern, the empathy for prisoners, are wondering, you know, how this is relevant to them. And one of the ways we try to bridge that, talking about environmental health issues, is that, you know, a lot of times I think prisoners have ended up kind of a canary in the coal mine situation. I think Chandra could probably speak to this about some prisons in Pennsylvania, but I'm going to give one example in Florida. It's very recent. And because the show's based in Florida, that, you know, just last month, residents of Orange County, where Orlando is, filed a class action lawsuit around a coal power plant that's been, you know, recorded causing rare forms of cancer that are only really associated with the contamination coming out of coal plants.
We need to take a brief break, and I'll get right back at you. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and we are discussing toxic prisons. Panayoti, I had to interrupt you, but will you continue with your thought?
Yeah, I was speaking of a class action lawsuit filed in Orange County, Central Florida, just last month, and it's regarding pollution and contamination that's affecting people's health and in the region. And that power plant happens to be right next door to the Central Florida Reception Center, which is a major Florida Department of Corrections facility. And it also houses a medical population, as I mentioned, for another prison in North Florida. So these prisoners are experiencing the health impacts, you know, in some cases, some of the most dramatic health impacts because they're the closest to these industrial sites. And on top of that, you know, they are considered to be in the custody of the state. So health impacts, you know, that they're experiencing really are the responsibility of the state or federal government that's housing them to address. And in that way, I think, you know, prisoners become, you know, a part of the environmental movement, the environmental health, environmental justice movement, because, you know, the record of how they're being polluted or mistreated really can and should be a part of addressing some of the bigger issues. It's not that power plant isn't just affecting prisoners. the lawsuit actually is, you know, is for people in neighborhoods for miles surrounding it. But some of the clearest health records could come from the prison itself because, you know, they're charged with responsibility for these prisoners. So I think looking at this kind of mutual relationship that prisoners are, you know, finding ways that we can connect, you know, like Shelby mentioned, we host movie nights or we bring out speaker systems and play music outside of prisons to connect on a human level. And that's important. And even more so on this movement level where, you know, we can bridge our concerns for environmental health, both with the people on the inside and those of us on the outside.
Chandra? Hello, Chandra, did you have comments?
I'm so sorry, I was on mute.
Oh, okay.
I can relate. Here in Pennsylvania, we have a prison, SCI Fayette, which is built either on or adjacent to coal ash waste. And there was a lot of poor health issues and cancer within the prison. And the way we worked is to go out into the community as activists and just as regular citizens, just to talk to the community about what was happening within the prison, and then come to find out that a lot of the people in the area also were impacted by the coal ash waste, as well as guards. So, I mean, at first it was, people were kind of reluctant because nobody really cares if things like that happen to prisoners. But once the community and the guards, you know, all got engaged, that it was, you know, it really helped.
Okay. As I think about this, can we talk a little bit about the forces that are at play? And when I say the forces that are at play, you know, I'm thinking of things like oppression and the role racism plays and those kinds of forces, economic discrimination, because all of that kind of ties it in and works hand in hand. You see it in prison, you see it in the community, so because the communities also reflect, you know, all these, we call them just isms, okay? And you're shaking your head, Shelby, so you have comments?
Well, one of the first things that I think of that I think is not one of the first things that people think of is the connection between toxic prisons here in the U.S. and toxic prisons in occupied Palestine. So I know we've talked a little bit about Palestine before. I think it's really important for framing to understand environmental injustice and its relationship to racism, and in the case of occupied Palestine, a racism against the, you know, the brown and indigenous peoples of that land. So when we talk about Gaza, right, Gaza, the largest open air prison in the world, where 96% of the water is undrinkable, we can think about prisons in Florida or Pennsylvania or South Carolina, where the water is undrinkable and it's filled with silt and soil and lead and who knows what else. And think about, you know, the fact that those prisons in Gaza and in Palestine, the prisons here in Florida, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, are funded by the same military-industrial complex. The same, you know, corporations that want to profit off of the labor of incarcerated people while keeping them sick and disempowered in the process. So that's one of the first things I think of is sort of the role of the military-industrial complex and industry, imperialism, Zionism.
Okay.
I think when it comes to forces of oppression working against people and them ending up in prison, I think we're all familiar with Michelle Alexander's work by the 13th Amendment. It's called The New Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And it talks about the school-to-prison pipeline and how slavery never really went away. in this country. It just kind of shifted. Seems more like
put on a different face, maybe.
I mean, even with, you know, schools, and that's something I'm really passionate about as an education student. When we're talking about schools and climate change and prisons and displacement, I think about in the Panhandle, where, you know, the party's been doing a lot of work around hurricane relief. We went to this one middle school and high school over Thanksgiving break to serve food, and we noticed that the school had received a $20,000 grant from Nestle. Nestle, the corporation which privatizes water here and abroad, which employs slave labor to privatize that water here and abroad, that is part, you know, one of those corporations that's creating the climate conditions that led to Hurricane Michael in the first place. And then thinking about the two schools in the Panhandle thus far that we know of that were closed just as a result, or the schools that were out of session for however many months. Thinking about the students whose parents and themselves were, their houses were destroyed and they were displaced, who were living in tent cities that were then evicted and destroyed and bulldozed in December. And thinking about, you know, basically, when you're homeless and when you're displaced and you have all these laws that criminalize homelessness, where are you probably going to end up if you don't have, you know, family somewhere so you can stay with? The likelihood is you're going to end up in prison. You're going to get arrested for, you know, laying on a street that you're not supposed to be laying on because it, you know, it's not good for business. It's not good for tourism. And so when you kind of like draw out all these connections, you can really see how schools and the environment and prisons and homelessness and climate displacement, like they are all connected by a continuous thread, even if the connections aren't immediately or like self-evident.
It's true. Pana, Yodi, comments?
Yeah, you know, I'm on the kind of the bigger picture direction that I think we're heading. I would, you know, throw in the documentation that has shown, you know, that environmental contamination is also a factor in the school to prison pipeline. The reports, you know, last year, I'm thinking of one from that was published 2017, the lead to prison pipeline that talked about environmental factors that, you know, certain demographics, low income children of color in the school system that are then, you know, whose health is impacted and their, you know, education is impacted by those health effects. And then they're basically routed towards the prison system. And we know that the school system, you know, looks at, takes grades and then decides how many prisons to build based on, you know, largely routing black communities into the prison system and from a young age. So, you know, looking at the environmental factors in that and considering the bigger picture of toxic prisons and, you know, the society that kind of gave birth to them, sort of fundamental, I think, in this system and the economic and political system we have that's so based on racism and historic injustices, you know, that started with the stealing the land that we all live on in this continent from the native people who lived here before. And here in Florida, you know, a lot of people go visit St. Augustine as a tourist attraction, but really St. Augustine was the first prison town in the hemisphere. You know, the Castillo de San Marcos was a prison for indigenous people participating in resistance at the time. So I think, you know, having that context that goes back a couple hundred years and then being able to connect with what's happening today is important. And I think racism and white supremacy is a huge part of that story.
To kind of add to what Taniyati was saying, I don't know how to put it, but I'm going to try. I think it's a type of an economic injustice or racism that's going on in a way that black and brown people aren't able to, you know, maybe get jobs or on the lower scale of the economy. And prisons are used as economy in areas, in rural areas, rural white areas. And like in Pennsylvania, when the coal mines closed, they put prisons in these towns mm-hmm. for people. And now that the prisons are being, you know, they're trying to lower the rate of people in prison and trying to release more people, people are fighting. I mean, people are actually protesting or whatever, saying that they want this prison, you know, in their city. They're not thinking of something else that they could do. Like I always suggest to our governor, perhaps you would give some type of educational training for, mm-hmm. for people in the rural areas and in the cities or something, you know, instead of using people, mm-hmm. you know, for your economy.
Because prisons don't really enhance that community at all. I mean, I think it's a big myth that you hear they're putting prisons and so the prisons are going to bring jobs. And that's not the case. I see you looking at me. You got comments, Brian.
Yeah, I lived in Pennsylvania for a little bit. And it's just full of these like barren towns that mm-hmm. used to have an industry that dried up, like coal or Bethlehem Steel was huge. Oh, yeah. I know they turned that factory, that plant, into a casino. And there's just nothing's being made mm-hmm. in the country, really. So it seems like the economy is driven by war and prisons, pretty yeah. much. Is there anything else?
Right.
Yeah, there's lots of counties in the, you know, more rural northwest Florida or central Florida that the prison is that county's economy where, you know, if you want work, the likelihood that, you know, you're going to get work is pretty centralized in that, you know, working for that prison.
But that's not a good job.
It's not.
At all.
And it's
degrading and it's
yeah, and it just fosters this ongoing culture of violence. Mm-hmm. And really when we're talking about the environment, there's so much, you know, legitimate and productive work to be done mm-hmm. in terms of ecological restoration. You know, we could be, instead of employing people as guards, we could be employing people as reforesters mm-hmm. or as coral reef restorers or, you know, with a job with dignity, obviously with good pay that doesn't necessitate being violent towards the people that you're basically the overseer for.
Right.
But unfortunately, in these rural counties, the kind of the two options are, okay, you're either a farmer with very, very limited resources because that's not valued under the sort of, you know, the form of capitalism in which we live, or you're a prison guard. Okay. And that's
not valued either.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, how do we fight? How do we fight this violence against humanity and the plant? I mean, basically, that's what we're talking about. It's a violence against humanity, regardless whether they're prisoners or not. You know, first of all, they're humans. They're people. What do we do? Where do we go? I mean, I'm asking you all, what about folks who are listening and they think, wow, what can I do? How can I make a difference? You know, what would you tell them? I mean, are there particular organizations that they should be aware of, or
So the way that I first got involved in prison organizing before I was part of any organization mm-hmm. before, because I really got plugged in after Operation Push, because I saw Operation Push happening, which for context was the Florida specific prison strike that happened last January in 2018. And I saw the really amazing like on the ground work being done around that. And I was like, I want to get plugged in. But before that, the way that I got involved, that anybody can get involved in, no matter where you are, no matter what organizations are in your area, is writing to someone who's incarcerated and creating a relationship with someone who's incarcerated. The organizations through which I was doing that, there's Black and Pink, which is an organization for advocacy for LGBTQ community members who are incarcerated. And then SWAP, Behind Bars. SWAP stands for Sex Worker Outreach Project, which is similar, obviously, like geared towards sex workers. There's mm-hmm. a lot of overlap in those communities, but In essence, they both have pen pal programs.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you go to the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee website, they have a list of incarcerated comrades who were put into solitary or faced some sort of retaliation for their involvement in organizing, you know, a state strike, be it Operation Push in Florida or something else in another state, or the recent national prison strike that happened this past August and September in 2018. And you can write to someone through that way as well. But I would really suggest that as a first step if you want to get your foot in the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you really want to show solidarity towards incarcerated people, talk to incarcerated people. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to establish that connection. And a lot of people who are inside, you know, are, again, like I said, hundreds of miles away from their families, are starving for some sort of communication. You know, and I know Brian has experience writing to political prisoners very specifically as well.
Right. I was wondering why you left that out.
Well, you can talk about it.
Okay. So at the Plant Collective, every third Thursday, we have a political prisoner letter writing dinner where we look at the case of specific political prisoners. Usually it's someone who has a birthday coming up and we all design a birthday card and sign it. And then we can write individual personalized letters if we choose. Yeah. And
people like, like Red Fawn, who was arrested, mm-hmm. I think, at Standing Rock,
right.
Leonard Peltier. A lot of these political prisoners were involved with the Black Liberation Movement
mm-hmm.
or the Indigenous Liberation Movement. And that was really cool. I've been to a couple letter writing dinners at the plant, and I think that they have a similar program at the Civic Media Center in Gainesville.
Hold your thoughts, then we're going to take a brief break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Team. Reports indicate that hundreds of prison and ICE detention centers are built on toxic sites and people are getting sick. Are they checking this out? Are they investigating it? Is anybody following this? What is happening as far as that's concerned to any of you?
I would like to, you know, maybe answer that question
okay.
and kind of bridge him back to what we were just talking about before the break. You know, mommy, putting you on the spot, Chandra, you know, I first met Chandra when I learned about the Dallas 6 case, which her son was part of, and, you know, I've since been inspired by both her and her son's work to recognize, you know, and put in front of people the conditions in the prison. And I think you guys mentioned political prisoners. And it's important to note that the political prisoners in this country aren't just people who got locked up because of their political advocacy on the outside. You know, after the last 30, 40 years of mass incarceration, you know, there are political prisoners who were basically, you know, came into their activism while incarcerated as youth. And I think there's a lot to learn from those folks on the inside. And Chandra, I wonder if you would talk about your son a little bit in that context.
Okay, yeah. My son went in as a kid. He was 18 years old. The things that he saw behind bars forced him into becoming a jailhouse lawyer and a very strong activist for human and civil rights within the prison. He was thrown into solitary for nearly 10 to 11 years, because of his activism, which also caused him to not be able to be paroled. So he ended up doing almost 19 years in prison because he was in solitary confinement. But some of the things that he witnessed while he was in there, he witnessed just torture and abuse of prisoners. While in solitary, he was starved to the point where he lost 20 pounds. I mean, he would write me to the outside, and I would I would call, fax, email anybody that I could, you know, to get help for him. And he was the type of person that he didn't care what would happen behind him being a whistleblower. So anything that he saw, believe me, we would know it on the outside. And he set up a network, like everywhere he would go. If he saw something, if he wasn't able to report it to me, another prisoner would report it to me. And that's kind of like what we have to do. We have to, like, stand behind these prisoners, you know, when they're standing up for themselves in there, and we have to let the public know what's going on. Like, a lot of how I got him help was by me being able to go out and speak in front of people, which is something that I never, like, I'm a person that didn't even, like, really talk to people much, shy. But I knew I had to get out here. I got out here, and I put the word out, and just from me, you know, going different places, I was able to eventually travel around the United States, even to London, to talk about prison conditions and stuff. So it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of it takes a lot of strength, and it takes a lot of understanding the prisoners, because mm-hmm. I was very naive of what was going on. And you know when it was just my son, I didn't really understand that this was happening everywhere until I just started talking to prisoners all over. So it, like I said, we really need to, like, stand behind prisoners. And I mean, anything you can do, if there's organizations in your area, go out and see what these organizations are about. You don't have to always be on the front lines protesting. Mm-hmm. You can commit your time. You can write letters. You can commit money. You know, mm-hmm. anything you can do on that line. We can vote. We can go talk to our representatives and senators about what's going on.
Jandre, what about cruel and unusual treatment? What about Amendment 8? Does it have any impact at all? Because it sounds like it doesn't. You know, the government is obligated to provide basic human needs. I mean, food and shelter and health and clothing. What's going on?
Yeah, none of that. Basically, the only way prisoners can get reprieve is to file lawsuits and complaints. And it has to get to the outside in order for it to, like, be heard and you know, possibly met. It's definitely cruel and unusual punishment. Mm-hmm. There's no other way, you know, to put it. There's nothing nice about it. There's nothing humane about mm-hmm. it.
I've heard some say, you know, the way to go with prison is the private prisons, and that the private prisons are much better. I'd like to have you all address that and speak to the whole private prison movement.
Mm.
So definitely, I think that we should be careful, right, to understand that, you know, although private prisons come with their own baggage, mm-hmm. the problem is not private prisons. The problem is prisons,
period.
Point blank, period. Yeah. And when we're talking about prison abolition, we're talking about all prisons, not just the private ones. That being said, you know, all prisons profit off of the exploited labor, the prison labor, the slave labor. But private prisons, definitely, there's even more smoke and mirrors, right? There's even less community accountability. You know, when you have these corporations mm-hmm. that are treated as basically people by our government, that have the same rights as people, First Amendment
rights,
so-called First Amendment rights,
right.
That can provide even more stumbling blocks for activists and organizers who are trying to challenge the entire system.
As we talk about these conditions, because there are so many things, but of where these prisons are built and the environment and the toxicity, what role, if any, does the EPA play? Or do they? You're looking at me.
I can
weigh in a little bit on that, because that was a big source of kind of inspiration, ironically, for the work that the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons began mm-hmm. with in 2015.
Okay.
We started an effort with the EPA around a public comment period they opened for their mm-hmm. EJ 2020, Environmental Justice 2020 plan. And they're supposed to be revisiting policies around environmental justice and health issues that the EPA could look at and provide, stronger input to other government agencies on how to advance environmental justice. And through that process, we started researching what the EPA had done in the past. And we were surprised and encouraged, actually, to find that there was a pretty long history over the last 20 years, mostly in Region 3, which is happens to be the Northeast, the region where Chandra is located, but also several other states in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast. And, the EPA had taken a strong stance in investigating prisons, and almost every investigation they conducted had multiple violations, and it ended up being fined or in some other way, government agency kind of repercussions for these contamination issues related to health, related to disposal of waste, related to water quality and air quality. But for some reason, they stopped. Instead of expanding that effort into other regions, Region 3 was kind of shut down. They did not continue or expand their prison initiative. In fact, when we started highlighting it through our public comments, and then I conducted an interview with the investigator, all of a sudden I went to look on the internet, the EPA's website, and they had removed all the documents and evidence of this prison initiative from the internet. Mm-hmm. And, we inquired about why that was, and they said, oh, they're updating their website. It was outdated
right.
content.
Mm-hmm.
But my opinion is that they, there's people on the inside that did not want, that sort of scrutiny being highlighted in the prison system, in particular because I think it's a weak spot of the prison system. It's like has these chronic problems with conditions of confinement and how they relate to the health of people that are supposed to be in the care and custody of the state. And so that inspired us to push harder and say this, we think this is a strategic place to change the prison system mm-hmm. and also to kind of bring the environmental movement into the real world. I think the environmental movement has rightly been criticized as a kind of narrow, middle-class white effort to, protect nature, animals, and trees. And really, in order to operate in the context of, the society we live in, the environmental movement needs to also address the human environment, human health, and how that connects to the conditions of the planet we live on. So, I think the EPA does and could have a huge role. We continued pushing. In fact, through that effort, we ended up getting a prison layer added to the EPA's map so that when you search for, environmental contamination using their environmental mapping system, there's now a layer of prisons in there that you can, this is how we gathered some of the data, like how many prisons are in proximity to Superfund sites, mm-hmm. for example. We got that from the EPA after pushing them to add prisons to their mapping software. So, hopefully that will continue. It's hard to tell under this current administration, what's going to happen in the EPA in the coming years. But at the moment, it still exists. The Environmental Justice Office is still there. Their website with the mapping software is still up, although they have not put the prison initiative documents back online, but we have. So we surface those, and you can find them through the Prison Ecology Project, which is the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons came out of, a collaboration with the Prison Legal News Research. So people check that out at prisonecology.org. And a lot of this history of environmental issues in prison has been documented through prisonlegalnews.org. You can find the database of the last almost 30 years of their articles and research.
Brian, you had some comments you wanted to say?
Back when we were talking about the EPA?
Yeah. I know we kind of jumped around, but I knew you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah.
And if it skipped you, we can come back. It's no big deal.
I just remember someone that worked for the DEP was saying that when Rick Scott came to town, he banned talking about global warming and using the term.
We couldn't use the term. Yeah,
global warming, climate change.
Okay.
And, you know, that's kind of like putting a gag on.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. We won't talk about it. You won't say it. You won't even want to acknowledge it. You know, it's basically it. Time is always flying. We only have about 4 minutes left. I wanted to have you talk about the First Step Act. Are you all familiar? I know you're familiar with it. And would you just comment on it? You know, talk about it. I know it's talked about. It's supposed to expand job training and other programming. And I didn't know how you all felt about it, if it was doing that or not. Any comments on the First Step Act? And if not, we're moving right along. Another thing that we have not addressed has been women in prison, and particularly pregnant women, and the fact that they are shackled, usually shackled during childbirth. I didn't know if you all had any comments or thoughts on just how women are treated in prison. You know, they have to go through all kinds of changes just to get personal hygiene items. So any comments?
So I actually can speak kind of to the experience of transgender women in prison.
Okay.
Because one of my close friends, like a big sister relationship with, is with my friend Patricia, who's incarcerated in Missouri. And she's trans, and I help facilitate communication between her and her, you know, daughters, so to speak, who are also trans. And kind of going back to what you're saying about cruel and unusual punishment, guards, you know, intentionally sexually harassing them during pat downs, knowing that, you know, they don't have as much legitimacy in the eyes of their COs because they are misgendered in the eyes of their COs. You know, one of our friends, Brianna, who's also incarcerated in Missouri, has had a $300 debt to the state for, false vandalism charges. And for months, every month, that $5 amount or whatever is deducted out of her commissary fund, whatever, the $5 that she earns throughout the entire month for her labor. She can't even afford, you know, Head and Shoulder shampoo to take care of her hair that she's trying to grow out. I cannot imagine
and
if
it
I
seems
was not
like things like shampoo and toothpaste and toothbrushes. You know, you shouldn't have to buy them.
Yeah, that should be considered a human right, just
human,
like
right.
food and water and shelter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hoops they have to jump through to try and get state issued, like, you know, gender affirming clothing. And things like that, and the hoops they have to jump through to try and see mental counseling or mental counselors who are specifically, you know, sensitive to the specific needs of trans people. It's just appalling. And, you know, I think that trans women and cisgender women who are incarcerated can find a lot of solidarity in their shared experiences of a special oppression as women, even if those things look different for them, you know, even if it's not necessarily for my trans comrades, like a question of, you know, being shackled in, you know, during labor.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely still a sense of solidarity with other incarcerated women because of that just absolute mistreatment and cruel and unusual punishment that's weaponized against them.
Well, we're out of time, but in this last 30 seconds, do you all have any projects that are forthcoming that the listening audience needs to be aware of that they may want to participate in?
Well, I would like to throw out there, since this show is based in Tallahassee, and we just had a pretty major update that the former Bureau of Prisons head, Mark Inch, has taken over the Florida Department of Corrections. You know, I'd like to, any listeners that might have connection to him or to that institution, you know, that we are definitely not letting up. And I think it was a bad decision to invite this person into Florida. And, you know, we're on the verge of the anniversary of Operation Push last year. There will be an escalation of protests and solidarity organizing with Florida prisoners.
I appreciate it. I'll have to have you all come back. That's it for this hour of 411 Team. Much appreciation. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.